It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Russia's attacks on Ukraine continue. We'll look at the global response and where things could go from here. First, who are the people, the individuals, the Wisconsinites who are working to fix what's broken in our society? A new project from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is answering that question in a series of pieces about people they're calling weavers. It's inspired by an initiative by the Aspen Institute to recognize and support people around the country building connections in their communities, effectively weaving social trust back together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who's bringing people together in your community? How would you rate the level of trust you have in your neighborhood, in your city? If it's high, why is that? If it's low, how come? What do you think needs to be done to raise trust, to bring communities in Wisconsin back together amidst a big partisan divide? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Haynes is the Ideas Lab editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His piece introducing this project for the newspaper came out earlier this month. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be with you.
Can you talk a little more about the inspiration behind this Wisconsin Weavers project?
Well, sure. I was at a speech by David Brooks at the La Follette School at the UW back in October. And, you know, he has spent the last several years going around the country and talking to people. And he was left with this feeling that people are feeling sort of ignored in some cases, not heard. He was struck by the amount of social isolation he was seeing. And so back in 2018 with the Aspen Institute, he founded what is called the Weave Project. And I was really struck by the...
I'm going to jump in, David. We have kind of a weird thing going on with the connection here. Our board operator will talk to you now. Talking to David Haynes about this new project through the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called the Wisconsin Weaver Project. You may have heard conversations like this on this show where somebody sees a problem in their community and does something to try to fix it. If you have done something like that, or you know someone who has, want to recognize them, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, we've got that connection, resolved now. So you were talking about, you'd heard that speech by David Brooks. The Aspen Institute's been doing this Weaver Project. What kind of things are you looking for in this project?
Well, thanks, Robin. Sorry for the interference there. So we know that in every community in Wisconsin, every city, village, and town, there are people who are doing great work to bring other people together, often across difference. And we just want to tell some of those stories. I think we're in a period where there's so much political polarization. There's so much in the news. If you listen to the radio, if you read the newspaper, it doesn't seem like anyone's talking to anyone. But in fact, in every community, there are people just doing really good work, and often under the radar and often underappreciated. Brooks talks about people who show up all the way, And these are people who, when you go into a community and ask who's trusted in that community, everyone seems to know them. And so I think about somebody, and I'll just give a quick example.
Sure.
In Milwaukee. There's a young muralist, her name is Tia Richardson, and when she does a mural, she gets together with the community, the neighborhood, and they talk about what that should be like. What do you want to see in the art that I'm going to create? And then when she creates the art on the side of a building or wherever, she often brings the neighborhood together and they paint it together. And there's often food and beverage. And so, you know, it's a community project. It brings people together. She's a weaver. There's a Southside coffee shop that's attached to a Spanish language school, part of Milwaukee Public Schools. They've opened a coffee shop where the kids can learn how to be baristas. These are middle school and high school kids. But they've also opened it up now to the community where people can come in and do book readings, or you have a guitarist maybe on Thursday nights. That's weaving. And so we want to tell some of those stories.
I think it can be easy to look at all the problems of a community, of a state, of a world, and think there's nothing I, one individual, can do to tackle that. And it seems like you're focusing on the people who don't let them that stop them.
That's right. And I think what Brooks found is that there are lots of people who, when they see something that needs to be done, they do it. They do it without being asked. They don't expect anything in return. They just help out. You know, it might be somebody in a neighborhood who just checks on all the older people in the neighborhood to make sure they're okay. There's a woman in Minneapolis, and her name's escaping me now, but a few years ago, she started inviting people she didn't know into her home for dinner. And one of the dinners that people always talk about is she had a group of people in, including someone who was homeless. And she asked the question, what does it mean to have a home? And that led to this really rich discussion. She's a great cook, so she made dinner for everyone. Well, that became kind of a program now that's been used by a number of institutions in Minneapolis, including the Minneapolis Police Department, to help bring people together. And so I think there are people like that all over Wisconsin that we can focus on.
Talking to David Haynes, the Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a new project there called the Wisconsin Weaver Project, looking to highlight the work, often unsung work, of people in communities around the state to bring people together in one way or another, to get past divides, to transcend divisions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about this, the kind of things they're looking for, or if you have an example to share in your own community, something big, something small, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And David, you are looking for nominations, right, for people to be featured in the Wisconsin Weaver Project?
We sure are, and we have a form that we've created that's embedded in a story that I did just a couple weeks ago announcing the project, and people can find that at jsonline.com/ideas-lab. That's jsonline.com/ideas-lab, and that story's free. Anybody can look at it. There's a form embedded in the bottom, and fill it out and send it to us. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can just email me at david.haynes@jrn.com.
I want to look at a couple of the other people you mentioned in that piece. You mentioned this is not just Milwaukee. An Appleton woman on the theme of addiction. Can you talk about her work there?
Yeah. So she went through, and we have a reporter who's just digging into this, and that story will be published in a couple of 3 weeks. But she suffered what is probably the worst thing can ever happen to a parent. She lost a daughter to an addiction. But since then, she's turned that pain and trauma into helping others who are going through similar situations. And she's become quite well known in the Appleton area for the work she's doing. Another piece that I'm actually working on out of La Crosse is a story that Wisconsin Public Radio actually did a year or two ago on a group there that calls itself Waking Up White. It's a group of white people in the community who worked with an African-American man from UW-La Crosse as their guide to understand racism, to sort of take responsibility for their role in racism in the community. And you know what they've done? They've created what I would call an ecosystem of care around racism in that community. So they have infrastructure now for when there's an incident or when something's going on that needs to be talked about. They've done a lot of group meetings. They've got the top people in the community involved. They've done videos that you can watch. They've got into the schools. It's really quite an impressive program. And again, that's weaving. That's bringing people together across difference.
David, I got to say, I really like this. When I look back at my career in public radio, such as it is, the ones I remember, you know, when people ask me what are my favorite interviews, it's this kind of thing. I think back a guy in Milwaukee who started up a community garden project for mostly teen guys there, or a Delafield pastor who started a Boys and Girls Club in that community. Public art projects in Green Bay and Fox Cities that brought community members back together as a broadcaster, as a journalist. That's the kind of thing that gives me the most satisfaction. It feels like I'm doing something important. Are you thinking that way after a fairly long career in journalism yourself?
I am, and I agree with you. And we just hope that by highlighting and lifting up some of the people who we know across every community in the state are doing good work, that we can encourage a few more people, maybe nudge them just a little to think when something needs to be done, they'll step up and do it. I think a lot of people do that anyway, but we would love to be able to do that. You know, you mentioned the stories that you've covered. I think of one. There's a woman and her son on Buffum Street in Milwaukee, in an area of town that unfortunately has been really plagued by a lot of violence in recent years. But on her block, not so much. She and her son have kind of taken charge of the block. They have a block party every year. They give away backpacks filled with school supplies for the kids in the neighborhood. There was a chop shop down the street. They got it shut down. There was a drug house on the block. They got it shut down by persistence. And it's people like that who really care and step up that I think it's rewarding for us to cover, but it's inspiring for us to see.
We're talking to David Haynes, Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a project the paper started telling stories about Wisconsinites who are weaving social fabric back together in their communities. People, as he said, who step up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does that call to mind somebody in your community, at your workplace, in your congregation, whatever it might be, someone who saw a problem and worked to fix it in the community, saw an opportunity, worked to bring people together to seize that opportunity? In tough times, do you like to hear stories like this? Do you want to see newspapers cover this kind of thing and radio stations cover this kind of thing more than maybe we do right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about people who are rebuilding social connections in their communities. Our guest is David Haynes, Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The paper started a new project highlighting the stories of some of these Wisconsin weavers, they're calling them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share, somebody you'd like to highlight in your own community? Somebody who saw a need and helped to meet it, you could join in right now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, the problem you're trying to solve here, you were starting to touch on that earlier. You wrote in that inaugural piece there about some of the loneliness, some of the detachment that seems to be coming along with our partisan and other divides.
Yeah, when I heard David Brooks speak in Madison back in October at the La Follette School, it really struck me some of the things he was talking about. He spent, as I mentioned earlier, about 3 years prior to establishing the Weave Project, just going around the country and talking to people in the wake of the 2016 election. And we all know that that was a very polarizing election with a lot of vitriol on both sides. And what he found was that large groups of people in the country felt left out. They felt unheard. There was a lot of social disconnection. It's become very easy to write people off. And the result is it's also become very easy to be sort of mean-spirited. We see that a lot, unfortunately, on social media feeds. I personally think it's very harmful. And the question is, what do you do about it? And I think that he decided, along with Aspen, and we've decided as well, that we just need to find people who are running counter to that and write about them and lift them up a little bit. Brooks talks about, and I agree with him, if you live in the media world, as you and I do, it's easy to get a little depressed because the news is often not so good and people are not so nice to one another. But actually, outside of that bubble, there are a lot of good things going on. So we just want to try to find a few of them.
Where should people look in their own communities to find these stories? Because I think it's easy to live in a place and see a problem and bemoan it, complain about it. I'm really good at doing that just in my daily life. How do we open our eyes and see the people doing this work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. What Brooks said, and I think this is really true, and I found it to be true as well, is they would go into communities and they would just start talking to people, and they would ask the question, who's trusted? Who's trusted in your neighborhood? Who's trusted in your community? And after a while, they begin to hear the same names. So I think people know who's doing the good work. I think of, I'll give you another example that I don't know if we'll write about this one, but I think it's an example of a weaver. There's a food pantry in the east side of Milwaukee that attracts a lot of people from the suburbs to come in and do good work, hand out food, work with people who are poor. But it's not just about handing out the food. They train people about what poverty is and who's impoverished and how that's changing in our city. And how many people are impoverished, and what it means to be impoverished, how your life changes. So you go through a little bit of training, and then you're encouraged to sit down at a table with someone who's a client and meet them, to learn their name and to get to know them. And so it becomes a human connection. So it's not just about passing out food, it's about weaving. And so I think that you ask, how do you find them? I think they're all over the place. Once you begin to look, you see a lot of people doing this kind of work.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sherry is with us in Madison. Sherry, hi.
Hi. Yeah.
What do you want to tell us about Sherry?
I just wanted to share my experience about how much difference positive news can make. I used to live in a small town in Idaho called Wendell, and it was a town of 2,000. And it was really kind of a dying town, and most of the storefronts were empty. We only had really like two businesses left in town. And people were very concerned that the town was going to close down. There was also like drug trafficking and other problems going on, and that was what was being reported. And I began reporting for the newspaper, and I began reporting on good things that were happening and good things people were doing and on each business that opened up, and beginning to show people that there were people who were making good steps in our town. And as I continued to do this, within a year, a big change had come. And by the end of 2 years, every storefront was full, and they were having to build new buildings to hold the new businesses.
Fantastic, Sherry. Thanks so much for sharing that. David, we hear about the broken windows theory where one bad thing can snowball into others. Sounds like Sherry had a reverse of that, the opposite of that. Highlight good things and other good things can follow.
Oh, Sherry, I love that story. That's just a wonderful story. And I think it's true. We're really good at, and we need to be as journalists, at exposing what's wrong and highlighting when things aren't going well. But there are other stories we should do as well. We should look at solutions. What are the ways to solve the problem, evidence-based ways to solve the problems that we have? But we also should focus on people who are just doing the good work, right? And as Sherry did. Great story.
Thanks, Sherry. We'll go next to Madison in Westby. Madison, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Madison?
So I wanted to talk a little bit about my mother, actually. Her name is Lisa. And she is this incredible woman who I hope to grow up half as cool. So she actually started a haunted house in the community. We host that in Viroqua, the next town over. And instead of taking the profits for, ourselves or herself, we actually go to a different charity every year and give the profits to the charities in the area so we can help out our local community financially. This year, we're actually going to do a little different pricing with it because we usually only charge $5 entry fee. This year, we're going to charge $7 or $5 with a canned good so that we can donate those canned goods to our local pantries, as well as financially benefiting one of the historical societies in our community because they actually get down and dirty and go into schools and uncover a lot of the historical truths that have been kind of hidden and lost to time. And they are very involved in holding up heritage and, teaching the younger generation about how the town came to be and
Madison, we're just about out of time, but thank you so much for sharing that story, David. And I often think, like, any cool community event like Madison and Madison's mom's haunted house, anything cool, a park, whatever, in a community that I enjoy, somebody like them started at some point.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome story. And Madison, if you wouldn't mind, go to jsonline.com/ideas-lab. Click on the top story and fill out the form at the end and enter your mom, please. Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story, Madison. I appreciate it. David, I mean, I feel like I hear you as you just share some of the stories. It sounds like you're encouraged and inspired just by encountering these stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you really are. It's easy in our business, as you know, to feel like feel a little negative sometimes because we have to report on some difficult stories. But it's good to be reminded that there are people doing great things out there, and we need to tell some of those stories.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
David Haynes is the Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about a new project he's working on that highlights people in Wisconsin who are doing stuff. Stuff that helps weave social fabric back together in their communities. If there's someone in your community who you think deserves some recognition as one of these weavers in Wisconsin, you can email our guest at david.haynes@jrn.com or visit the website he mentioned and nominate someone, jsonline.com/ideas-lab. Again, that's jsonline.com/ideas-lab. Coming up after the news, we dive into the latest coming out of Ukraine, including an effort at peace talks, and a growing list of countries joining various sanctions against Russia. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new documentary marks 50 years since the creation of UW-Madison's only newspaper by and for Black students. We talked to the director of the documentary and a reporter for the paper in its early days during the 1970s. Now, Russia's attack in Ukraine is in its fifth day. The two sides met today for peace talks that are set to continue later this week. A number of countries across the world have condemned Putin's invasion, and the United States and other Western powers have stepped up their sanctions against Russia. Military, financial, and humanitarian aid is flowing into Ukraine, but the country's leaders say they're going to need more. We're checking in on the latest developments out of Ukraine to try and figure out what could happen next, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the reports coming out of Ukraine? Are you hopeful that the conflict could end soon? What do you think of the sanctions piling up from countries around the world? Do you think there needs to be more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She's chair of the Department of Russian, Central European, and Eurasian Studies there and chair of the Department of Political Science. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It feels like a lifetime in some ways, just a handful of days. What are your thoughts now 5 days into this Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Oh, that's a great question. I do feel like it's been a very overwhelming last 5 days. As someone who watches this region very closely, for the last several weeks, we've been paying attention to changes on the ground and changes in the geopolitical atmosphere. I think things started to take a very ominous turn really a week ago, when President Putin first recognized Donetsk and Luhansk as autonomous regions, and then gave this very bizarre statement to the Russian public that made just some very aggressive claims that would suggest that things were taking a very ominous turn. That being said, I didn't necessarily anticipate a full invasion on Thursday. So now that we're 5 days into this, I think we're at a very interesting juncture. We've seen that Ukraine is proving itself to be very resilient to a military invasion, for which it was unprepared. It's stayed very resilient militarily. It stayed very resilient politically. We've seen allies come together very quickly to put together a very aggressive plan of action to try to force the Russian government out of its economic comfort zone. So I'm thinking we're at a really interesting turning point right now.
The United Nations made a rare move to convene its General Assembly in a special session, many countries calling for an end to the war. I'm going to give a listen to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressing the situation in his speech to open that session earlier today.
We need to look forward as United Nations to overcome the scourge of war. We need to focus on solving problems, not making them worse. In cities around the world, people are taking to the streets and demanding an end to war. People in Ukraine want and need peace. And I believe people in the Russian Federation do too. We need peace now.
The international response, we're seeing traditionally neutral countries like Switzerland stepping up and saying, yeah, we're going to hold Russian assets for now. Sweden and Finland contributing military aid to Ukraine. What do you make of this? And now Germany also widening its support for Ukraine. What do you make of this increase in the number of countries and the intensity of the support they're giving sanctions and to helping Ukraine?
I'm impressed with how quickly it has come together. I think obviously Switzerland setting aside its neutrality is a very important piece of this puzzle, because ultimately what we're seeing from Vladimir Putin is that he's not willing to simply come to the negotiation table. He needs to actually be forced to that negotiation table. He needs to feel it in such a way where he can no longer support this war. And it seems to be that a unified financial intervention is what's necessary. And Switzerland was a really important part of this. But it's not just Switzerland. I mean, obviously that's a very significant piece. But I would say an even bigger piece has to do with the number of countries that have come together to essentially force the Russian central bank to have insufficient access to its currency reserves. These are absolutely necessary to prop up the Russian ruble. Without having access to the types of reserves that are held in foreign banks, it will be impossible for the Russian central bank to maintain its currency. The ruble is already losing its value very, very rapidly. We're likely to see a very strong and devastating impact on the Russian economy that will be impossible for Putin to avoid.
We're talking to Danielle Lussier from Grinnell College, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the news you're seeing from around the world, 800-642-1234. What you want to hear from President Biden, maybe at the State of the Union address tomorrow, what actions you ought to see taken or not taken in response, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. It's been hazy, Danielle, as to what Vladimir Putin had hoped to get out of this. Are we starting to get a clear picture of what he was hoping the end game of this invasion would look like?
I think he was certainly hoping that it was going to go much more quickly. As best as we can tell right now, we see very little reason to think that he was prepared for a long-term invasion, right? We have troops that are running out of gas on the ground. He expected to be able to go in and essentially topple the Ukrainian government very quickly and then be able to negotiate some sort of ceasefire that would lead to a long-term political control, the long-term political control over Ukraine. I think going in, he envisioned being able to bring Ukraine, at least initially, back into Russian political control and ultimately potentially strengthen his overall grip on a number of different territories that had predominantly been part of the Russian Empire. Now, I think that since this has not gone as quickly or smoothly as he envisioned, the endgame might be different. I don't think he was prepared for a war that would last many months. I certainly don't think he was prepared for having access to foreign Russian central bank assets being frozen and the inability to conduct a lot of Russian economic practices being crippled as a result.
One of the big stories of the last bunch of years has been misinformation campaigns interfering in elections around the world, including the U.S., but not limited to the U.S. And a lot of efforts seemed pointed toward breaking up NATO, creating divisions within NATO. It seems like this invasion, if there was any progress on that front, this invasion has just removed all of that. Did this backfire in a way that Putin may not have expected?
I think that's exactly right. I think part of the, you know, thinking about the role of NATO in all of this, one wants to just sort of bear in mind that Ukraine has aspired for greater European integration for many years now, economic integration, but of course also wanting security guarantees. And those security guarantees go all the way back to the early 1990s when the Soviet Union was first dissolved, when Ukraine agreed to return the nuclear weapons that were on its territory back to Russia, primarily for the overall security of the nuclear complex. And in doing so, did so in an environment in which it never perceived itself as potentially being on the receiving end of a Russian military attack. The slow move or the gradual move that Ukraine has sought to gain greater integration into European economic and security structures over time has been perceived by Russia as being very, very threatening. And I would say many scholars, myself included, look at various types of Russian intervention into Ukrainian domestic politics going back over the past 20 years as one of the goals of that being to essentially make Ukraine so unstable as to make it impossible for it to join the European Union or ultimately to enter into NATO. So this goal here that I think has had for many years has to do with reducing these opportunities to bring NATO closer to the Russian border. And I think it's backfired by showing the strength. I mean, again, seeing Germany agree to meet its NATO commitments in terms of contributions to military armaments, et cetera, this has been something that I don't think Russia was counting on.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding this sham negotiation table that Ukraine has been brought to, which appears to be purely about Russian grandstanding. I have a fear that the reason Putin demanded this show was because there is something that he wants people to be distracted from, or some action that he is buying time in order to be able to take. And I just wonder if anybody has been addressing these sorts of concerns or has any thoughts about what might be going on.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Danielle, in hindsight now, it seems like Putin wasn't negotiating in good faith leading up to last week. Is there any reason to think he might be negotiating in good faith starting this week?
No, I don't think so. But I do wonder if part of what he's trying to get out of this situation would be, now that it's very clear that he's prepared to continue and to continue in a very aggressive and dangerous manner, I wonder if he's thinking, okay, what can I get to extract out of the situation? So maybe I'm not going to get everything that I wanted. Could I still walk out of this situation potentially with something else? So for example, and I've seen this reported in a couple of places in the press, but again, none of this can be verified, that Putin was planning to go into today's negotiations with a demand that the international community recognize the sovereignty of Crimea. So for example, Crimea has been under de facto Russian control now for 8 years, but it continues to be recognized by the United Nations and the international community as being part of Ukraine. And the United Nations General Assembly voted to reaffirm that as early just in December 2019. So this has been an ongoing issue where the international community continues to recognize Crimea as being part of Ukraine's territory. Putin may be going into this saying, okay, look, give me Crimea, and I'm willing to consider a negotiation to cease other types of hostilities. Or let's recognize, for example, internationally recognize these two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, and let's maybe put forward in a couple of years a referendum that they could join Russia. So he may be trying to see what he could extract out of the situation to make it look like some type of domestic win, therefore, you know, ending other types of ending sanctions and being able to move forward and saving some face.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Grinnell College political science professor Danielle Lussier about the latest developments in Ukraine. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the global response to the invasion of Ukraine. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Danielle Lussier, political science professor at Grinnell College, with us today checking in on how Ukraine and the world are responding to Russia's invasion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the international response has been strong enough? Do you worry about Russia's nuclear capabilities? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chad is with us in Reedsburg. Chad, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a quick question. So let's say that the sanctions do take hold and Russia is forced out for whatever reason. Is there going to be some penalty that Russia will have to face beyond that? So if they move out tomorrow, do the sanctions immediately stop? Or is there, do we take Crimea back? Is the sanction continue? I'll take my call offline.
Thanks for the call. If this problem resolved quickly, what would happen next, Danielle?
That's a great question. It's kind of amazing the number of different instruments that were put into place in the past 5 days. And I don't think that any of those would disappear overnight, right? I think that we would see that there would be a gradual rollback of some of the sanctions, probably based on different elements of demilitarization. I mean, at this point, Russia has put, by best estimates, over 150,000 or approximately 150,000 troops into Ukraine. It has engaged in a wide range of other types of damages. Now, there are a couple of really important things that I think would probably be tied to some type of conditionality here as well, that the separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, which have been active, you know, military zones for 8 years, with some exception. There's been some peaceful moments, of course. Russia has never taken responsibility for arming those regions, right? Those are areas that are called, they are termed as separatists, but there seems to be quite a bit of evidence suggesting that the armaments that have been used in that territory were brought in by Russia. So I could envision that there would be a range of different bits of conditionality that would have to come out before different types of sanctions would be reopened. I think the question of the status of Crimea, and I think the question of the status of these other regions would also probably need to be further discussed. I suspect, though, that there's going to have to be a very broader conversation that happens within the United Nations Security Council, as well as within sort of the broader international community, in the sense of, this has been the biggest assault in Europe that we have seen since World War II. I'm not quite sure what types of punishments Vladimir Putin will have to experience, but I don't think that it is going to be as simple as just lifting sanctions. I think that there's something much greater that's going to come out as a result of this. And I think that what we've seen so far, that's probably something that's going to come out when there's collective agreement among allies about what type of consequences Putin and Russia should face.
Thanks for that call, Chad. I wanted to ask you, Danielle, I know you've in the past had your eye on Russian public opinion, protest and dissent in that country. From as far as we can tell from our vantage here in the Midwest, what are we seeing when it comes to the reaction to the war from Russian people?
That's a great question. And I think that we have to sort of divide up the different categories of the population, if you will. There has been a very strong and immediate calls of dissent from, I would say, the intellectual and artistic class, the leadership in Russia. There is an open letter of protest that's been circulated by Russian scholars and universities. There have been any number of musicians and members of the cultural elite who have spoken out against the war very vocally. There have also been a number of individuals out trying to protest the war. Of course, something we have to really think about is that Russia is a very autocratic regime. It is, one might even argue, in some places, it's a police state. So engaging in any street level protest is very dangerous. And yet, even within that, we see that people are going out there and they're facing the possibility of arrest, especially in some large cities. Now, The other piece that we need to think about is that Russian television media is state controlled and it's spewing an awful lot of propaganda right now. So the average Russian who maybe hasn't been following these details very, very closely, went into last week with public opinion that looks sort of the following. You know, about 40% or more thought that the recent buildup in tensions between Ukraine and Russia was a result of the West, that this was something that the West had introduced. We have some data from about a month ago that suggested at that point in time that fewer than 10% of Russians wanted to see military action in Ukraine or wanted to support Russian military action in Ukraine. However, there was a much larger percent of the population that was willing to support, you know, if these eastern territories in Ukraine wanted to separate on their own, they could. Now, I think we have some reason to believe that this propaganda is really working in some segments of the Russian population, that there are people who believe Vladimir Putin when he says that this is necessary. At the same time, I don't know that we have a good sense of how well many Russians understand what is entirely going on. There are many who seem to be very skeptical of the information that they're receiving, but at the same time, they're skeptical enough of other types of sources that they're having a hard time discerning the truth of what's in here. I do think that we'll see more anti-war support, if you will, or more anti-war sentiment expressed as the economy starts to collapse.
Time for one more caller. Stephen is with us in Cumberland. Stephen, hi.
Hi. Glad to talk to you.
What did you want to bring up, Stephen?
I have a question and a proposal. I have been watching this conflict and have a feeling that there is an issue of Putin's legacy involved here from a much broader perspective than specific challenges to specific pieces of land like Crimea or the eastern regions. And my theory is this, that I think he is trying to cement his legacy at the end of his regime. And the final piece is the Ukraine, and he has announced that he wants to replace the leadership. The only way he can do that, in my opinion, observing what's going on, is to impose such pain on the population that the decency and the honorability of this distinguished man, Zelensky, has no choice but to resign on behalf of the humanitarian interests of his population.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just a little over a minute left, Danielle. Is that a worry that the next step might be to inflict such widespread punishment on the Ukrainian population?
I would not put that past Vladimir Putin. And I agree with this caller. I think that this is what Putin wants for his legacy. He wants to reunite those great Russian lands. But I am more optimistic in the sense that I think we've seen such resolve among the Ukrainian people, and we've seen allies come in and really bolster up the regime and bolster up the state in ways that they can. And so I'm more optimistic that it will be impossible for Vladimir Putin to accomplish that goal.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute, Danielle, what things are changing and quickly, what do you have your eye on next?
What I have my eye on right now has to do with this possible potential movement into the EU. I'm really interested in seeing what's going to happen with these negotiations potentially continuing. And I'm also really, I'm watching also just to see how much more the Ukrainian resistance can continue, given that it's getting fresh supplies and more resources.
Danielle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She focuses on Russia and Eastern Europe in her work. She's the chair there of the Department of Political Science. She was with us today talking about the Russian war on Ukraine and where things go from here. Stay up to date on the latest news from Ukraine here on the Ideas Network. NPR will be bringing updates throughout the day. You can also go to WPR.org. Our colleagues at NPR, their reporting will show up there as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer Kent and her guest for a preview of the State of the Union address and let us know what you want to hear from President Biden. You can get that preview. We'll do a post view on Wednesday, and you can of course, hear the actual event itself. Tune in to any of our Wisconsin public radio stations around the state or listen live at WPR.org to tomorrow night's State of the Union address from President Biden. You can get a head start on it. Let us know what you want to hear from the president. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's State of the Union coverage tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Seen any good birds lately? Pickings can be slim this time of year, but I know that dedicated and skilled birders are still seeing some cool stuff. And sometimes even I do too. I mentioned a couple weeks back that I went to Yellowstone State Park and saw a bald eagle coasting over the shore there. Yesterday at Picnic Point on Madison's Lake Mendota, we hiked around without spotting any birds, but then we spotted a really big flock of birders. And they were doing a guided tour, and as we walked by, they spotted an owl. And with their help and their pointing and some careful explanation, we got to see it too, just sleeping the day away, perched high up on a branch. It's good that they helped me out. I would have missed it completely. I'm not good at, like, noticing things. Have you seen any good birds lately? Share your sightings and pictures if you have them. Email us, centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. Bird news you can use. This is Central Time.